Well, g'day, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Lucinda Holdforth, who is the former speechwriter to Australian Labor leader Kim Beazley and Qantas CEO Alan Joyce, amongst others, as well as the author of several books, including most recently, 21st Century Virtues, How They Are Failing Our Democracy, which we reviewed for the Australian newspaper. Today we discuss whether there has been any change to the modern corporate values which Lucinda was so critical of since the publication of her book, what is the cause of the changes to our virtues and manners? Social media, self-help gurus like Brené Brown, or something else? Her thoughts more generally about baby boomer liberalism and whether there was any great thought given to the social and economic structures which were so dramatically pulled down during that time. And much, much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Lucinda Holdforth, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thank you, Dan. Great to be here.
We got to know each other because I reviewed your book, 21st Century Virtues, How They Are Failing Our Democracy, which came out in mid-2023. Have things got any better, in your view, in the corporate world since that time?
They've changed, haven't they? When I wrote that book, I was critiquing the way in which a set of modern virtues had taken hold, proved extremely useful for big corporates to appeal to younger generations and, they thought, to their staff. And those virtues are things like authenticity and vulnerability and telling my truth and my lived experience and self-care as a big thing. And so this became part of their modus operandi in the big corporate, often especially dealing with well-educated young people, so law firms and so on. And what it meant was you had a whole lot of kind of identity politics entering the place and a whole lot of identity discussion. And so I don't know if you've read, there's a book written by a young Australian woman novelist called Diana Reid, and she has a scene where young lawyers are gathered for drinks, and especially for the gay lawyers, and her friend just saying, I don't want to be a gay lawyer. I just want to be at work being a lawyer. So what we've seen since I wrote the book, even in a short time, has been the referendum, the voice referendum, and that was so comprehensively voted down that there was a perception in that we didn't need to worry about inclusion and diversity anymore, and that there was, in fact, a backlash on this. And so quite a few of them have turned away from it quite explicitly. So it's been an interesting shift.
Yeah. Do you think LinkedIn, which you single out for criticism, do you think it has been responsible for a change of culture in the corporate world? Or do you think it's just provided a window into that world that people maybe weren't aware of beforehand?
You know, it's really hard to tell with these big kind of systems, because I'm only perhaps in one bit of it. Perhaps there's other bits where people don't talk about this stuff. But I'm in the bit with people that do communications mostly, sort of speech writing and all that stuff. And that gets closely linked to HR. And so where this whole industry really took off is the HR community. And this was kind of like an HR takeover of corporate Australia. And I think they have been running it. So I'm very glad to see a kind of retraction in that area. And I don't think LinkedIn is the cause. I think it just simply reflected what was going on. And I think it perhaps accentuated it or, you know, reaffirmed those ideas for people that are on LinkedIn, as all those social media sites do. They reaffirm people's pre-existing prejudices.
Yeah. Do you think, what social media are you on these days, and what's your
Hardly any. I'm on LinkedIn for entertainment and, you know, just to see what's going on. And I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on Instagram. What else am I not on? I can't even remember. I am. Twitter. I follow him on X. I don't think I've ever put a tweet up on X, but I want to see what people are saying on that. Mm. So that's it. That's my social media.
And what do you think about X? Because I think there's been a reaction against that from portions of the corporate world. They prefer LinkedIn because it's not as no holds barred sort of fighting on, as occurs on LinkedIn. But I always find, actually increasingly find, there's a huge divide between people who get their news from X and get their news from you know, traditional broadsheets or the traditional news channels. What do you think?
Well, I don't get my news on X. I go to X to see how people respond to the news. Mm. That's what I do. And I go to LinkedIn. And I would also say that manners on LinkedIn have deteriorated quite considerably too.
Okay.
It doesn't, it's not as nice as it used to be. I don't know if it's good or bad, but we're in a very tense time. And I think people are worried about how they should present themselves in the public domain, what's the right and ethical thing to do given what's going on. So I think we're seeing those tensions play out online, inevitably, in fact. So, yes, I don't get any news from X, but I like to see how people are framing what's going on.
Mm. Oh, we should post more. Get it. Come on in, the water's fine.
I have a burst on LinkedIn every now and then when I feel amused or outraged on things. And then Jesus. I think time for a rest.
Yeah. Well, you wonder whether it does good. I think it does do good in some ways to signal to other people. But LinkedIn, it's all public, whereas Twitter, you can kind of, well, various channels you can talk more privately. So it's whatever
Dan,
you post.
Can I ask you what you're on? What social media are you? Are you
I'm on LinkedIn, but that's just for professional stuff. I don't post anything there. I try and keep that world separate to the sort of more world of ideas or, you know, criticism. So X is much more interesting to that. I still use X as more of just a distribution means of sending out articles or highlighting media content like this. I mean, I'll post this on X. I haven't really dived in the same way that other people have, commenting, you know, on everything, which I just don't have the time to do. And I don't necessarily want to become that sort of, you know, controversialist on a day-to-day basis either, but I do think that X, if you curate it, is a far superior channel for news. If you do it well, I think it can be. I think if you know what you're looking for, it's like a news ticker but with commentary in real time. So I find after reading X, going back to the broadsheets, it's like 2 weeks old. It's just people dumping their opinions. There's no sort of interaction. I find it really stale. And I do notice a massive difference between those who use X and those don't. I mean, the world's views are quite different. It's a problem, actually, because people don't know what other people are talking or listening to. So, yeah. So
just remember that I do use X very much for one thing, which is in football, and I'm feeling angry at how the Swans are going. I go on and watch the other Swans fans going, what? I think, yes, I feel great solidarity with the agony. And I love, like, whether the umpire's done something wrong, that's the equivalent of your news thing. It's in real time. I'm on the telly, watching on the telly.
Yeah,
and it's like, there's people and we are all in pain. That is the place I get.
Well, I'm not an AFL, I'm a league fan, but I do notice they all trend the scores on Twitter. But I prefer to watch that like just live. So it's a different I don't know. It does provide comfort, for different if you're looking for it. But it also
exactly.
One of your themes in your recent books has been the change in our virtues and our manners. What do you ultimately think is driving these changes?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think the change in virtues is really interesting. I mean, I ascribed that change. Well, it's interesting when you think about it, because of the HR takeover, which is all about people that have studied psychology at a fairly low level or done something like that. Organizational ideas and so on. So a set of ideas arose about individualism. So the 20th century was the era where the individual rose, wasn't it? And we had economic growth and prosperity, and people were free to enact their own lives and in countries like ours and in America and elsewhere. And then that stage has been one where it's not just individualism, it's a complete self-centeredness, a complete self-focus. And part of that, of course, has been the demise of Christianity and organized religion as a kind of force in life. So that just left an individual thinking about themselves, putting their self before society, putting their feelings before facts. And gurus like Brené Brown promoted an idea of acknowledging your vulnerability. She said that owning your story and telling it to the world is the bravest thing you could ever do, which I doubt very much. And she really proselytized this idea that sharing your pain, telling your lived experience, having your own perspective and promoting being incredibly transparent to the world, and most of all being authentic, whatever authentic means, would render you a good and happy person in modern life. And that, of course, fed beautifully into the HR takeover in a way, because then it would go around looking after all the different individuals in the organization, which justified even bigger numbers of people.
Yeah, I know who Brené Brown is. If you look, you'll often see Brené Brown as someone that people on LinkedIn of a particular type follow. But maybe just explain to
Brené Brown
and a lot of other people that don't read those books who exactly she is, and why do you think she in particular has she just tapped into something that was already there, or has she genuinely sort of changed things further?
Well, for those who are interested or even not interested, you only have to go into Dimmicks, to the self-help section, and there's about 7 Brené Brown books. She started in 2010 giving a TED talk. TED has a lot to answer for, doesn't it, by springing people on us. And she gave this talk called The Power of Vulnerability, and everyone absolutely loved it. And maybe that coincided with the online world and that was more algorithmically driven, maybe a sense of kind of isolation. I don't know. I think historians will have to judge that shift. She just tapped into it, and she just gives book after book after book. One is about the power of your imperfections, just to love your own imperfections. I mean, it's just an extraordinarily self-satisfied closed circle philosophy. And it absolutely justifies then complete self-interest, self-focus, and self-absorption. And it's perfect target for sort of capitalism, because then if you're obsessed with yourself, then you go and spend all your time nurturing yourself, pampering yourself, curing yourself, whatever. So it has served the system so well that I think it's been promoted and encouraged. And that's how we've gotten away from ideas around, you know, honesty, truthfulness, trustworthiness, these old-fashioned virtues, resilience, a loyalty to the community and what that means. So these ideas, of course, are still there, and many people still represent and reflect them and believe in them. But if you were to look on LinkedIn, you don't see that very much. You certainly don't see it on Twitter. And you see what you see is a kind of self, and even inclusivity and diversity push is a kind of an expansion of that idea of we are all these unique individual selves. So it promotes that idea of you are special, I am special. I think, you know what, we're just all citizens in a community. That is actually a much more healthy way of looking at our human life today.
Do you think there's a generational divide? Because I, for example, on the gender issue, the gender fluidity stuff, you know, men can become women and women become men. I've noticed that people who come from the left, like yourself, you know, J.K. Rowling, I don't know, and others, just think this is crazy. But a younger generation of women genuinely do believe it, and are genuinely open to the idea that gender, sex is a social construct and all that stuff. Why do you think that is?
Well, I know that that's true. There's definitely been a kind of shift. And what interests me most about this discussion, it's about a tiny sliver of the community, and that the young people and the people proselytizing this tend to be well-educated and middle-class. And if we wonder why Trump was elected this time, you only have to look at the way in which working class concerns were ignored by the Democrats for so long in favor of these other issues. So in favor of multiple minorities, instead of looking at what are the real issues facing, you know, declining standards of living and terrible work insecurity and massive income inequality. And so here, there, and in the UK, that's what startled me more. And I do think that that's part of the selfishness, you know, the self-absorption. And we pick individuals who are vulnerable instead of saying who are the groups in our community fundamentally and who merit that real attention politically. And that's where we should be looking. So, yeah.
But why the younger people? Why the younger people then? In particular, is it simply just that we started off, well, let me give you my little two bits. We started off this liberalism and it enabled a lot of freedom of a particular generation, but eventually you come to a natural consequence down the road where people, where once they threw off restraints of religion and stuff, now don't want to be bound by definitions of gender and the like. Is it not just the eventual destination of where you're going to end up?
It might be. Look, it might be that. I mean, I think, you know, I have lived most of my life in Surrey, kind of metres from Oxford Street, Sydney. So I'm very familiar with the gay community and what people now call the queer community, but they didn't when I was going, you know, on Mardi Gras nights or whatever. And yeah, I'm completely comfortable with the idea of people living different lives or living their own lives in their own way. The political question really is what happens when a minority rights impinge on the majority? So that's the fights are actually very material. They're about bathrooms and changing rooms, you know. There are ways you can fix that, right? Mm. So the political outrage over these issues is kind of hyped up beyond actually their significance to the day-to-day life of of anyone, in fact. Mm. That's what's interesting, and that might be a diversion. It might be a group of people looking for meaning and looking to express some goodness in themselves. I don't know. But we also know that it's always younger generations that push change, and that might be really healthy. They're out there trying to sort of change the way we think about a whole lot of stuff, and so it will all resolve itself over time and we'll come to some accord that will be quite sensible. Everyone will calm down and this will stop being a huge issue. Or a recession will tip in and that will solve the problem because we'll all be thinking of something else.
Maybe. Well, how do you describe yourself politically these days?
Interesting. I don't describe myself politically. I think I'm a conservative in a lot of areas. So I believe in conserving the environment. That's the area. I believe in tradition, not all of it, but I believe in understanding it and looking at it and taking it seriously and thinking and not automatically saying the past is bad. So I'm in some respects, I'm definitely, and I believe in, I care about art and history and all those things. So that, I guess, makes me potentially someone who's conservative. But politically, I am resolutely progressive. And that's because whatever we love from the past, we can't dwell there. We can only look forward. And so the solutions that we have must go forward. And in the last couple of years with democracy under threat, I guess I have become passionately interested, like many people, in what does a democracy mean? What does it look like? How do we make it better? How do we protect it? How do we know when it's not a democracy anymore? What's the signs? Mm. And so that's kind of where I sit. That's kind of not an answer, is it really? But that's the best
you can do. It's a good enough one. How do you convince people from the left about the value of tradition or why it might be important?
You can't convince anyone of anything these days. People just have their own view. I have a niece and nephew just going into high school. And I think my nephew, he's not due to go in for 2 years, but they come around and stay here. There are books everywhere and histories everywhere, books of history and books of everything, literature, the whole lot. He doesn't take any notice of it, but then he went and spoke to somebody, and his father said to him, "I'm interested in how the past influences the present and the future." I thought, the best thing you can do is teach history, teach concrete history, not teach the virtue of history, but teach stuff that happened. And that's how you start, as you know, you build up a picture of the world. So I think the biggest thing we could do for the future, or one of the biggest things, is promote the teaching of history in schools and promote not ideology, actual stuff, and promote civics education, how societies work.
Yeah, there's a famous, well, Chesterton's fence, it's an expression, right, which you might be familiar with. Okay, it's from G.K. Chesterton, who said a lot of things about a lot of times, but it says that if there's a fence in a paddock, unless you can fully explain why that fence was put up and the gate was put up, you should not tear it down.
Yeah.
Do you think that a lot of the social infrastructure and restrictions that were put in place in the past were not understood by let's call it baby boomer liberalism?
Yeah, baby boomer liberalism. Yeah. The baby boomer generation. Well, actually, you know what? I don't know what you're talking about, Dan. What do you mean?
Well, there was a lot of tearing down of social restrictions. You know, released a lot of energy and freedom. Emancipation of women, marriage laws changed, it's always cast as a progressive type of move, something that for some reason or another, previous generations, didn't get, but miraculously, a generation that was born in the 60s seemed to uniquely understand, were capable of doing without. And so, I think in a lot of cases they didn't really think on why those restrictions might have been there in the first place. And I guess it's hard, right? How do you tell a legitimate, reasonable restriction, even though you might not like it, and something which should rightly be cast away with?
I think we are the first generation in human history, sort of as a whole, the first cohort in human history where we have to create our own boundaries. That's the reality. No one is going to stop us doing anything. So we don't have we're not going to go to the organized religion telling us what we have to do and not do. And we're not going to go back to the manners of the past telling us what we have to do or not do, the sort of social restrictions and the social order. So that is a really critical challenge for everyone. And part of that is, where do we find meaning in our lives? And of course, for many of us, the meaning that we find is in the things that are the hard things. When we study really hard for an exam, parents bringing up their kids, the sacrifices they have to make. So we're not going to go back. People will be able to do almost anything. And the question will be, what things do we choose to do and what things do we choose not to do? And that's a really, really hard challenge to have that freedom. And that's what we face right now. And I mean, I look at that and I look at kids today and I think anything is possible for you. How hard is it then? Even things like illegal drug taking, I've got they're young, these ones, but I know that teenagers and in Sydney, young people routinely take illegal drugs. So the law doesn't seem to even worry them. I always grew up, I took the law seriously. Even legal restrictions people don't take seriously because they think they can get around them. So And I don't think that those people necessarily have happier lives because they are totally, if they think, free to do whatever they want. So I think part of our maturing in this era is what do we do with our freedom? And allied to that is an even kind of trickier question. And what do we do with our freedom when we're all going to live till 90 or 95? That's a terrifying question. And I think that's what as a society and as individuals.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, why are we freer though, really? Is it so we've convinced ourselves that we don't need these restrictions? There's technological changes which have allowed us to do things, but is that the real?
There's no penalty on marriages, families breaking up. There's no penalty on who you want to have sex with. There's no penalty on what drugs you take. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. We can do whatever we want, basically. Money is the only limitation, which is why money is such the big topic for everyone. But apart from that, that is literally the limitation on people's freedom to act. And I don't believe that there's any other social censure that really applies now.
But is that a good thing? I mean, like on the marriage thing, there's 50% of in London at our conference, the stat came out, which 50% of the people in Greater London, the children grow up in a family where it's a single parent family, or they don't see both parents under the one roof. I mean, that wasn't always the case, right? Is that a positive thing? I mean, is it not? There's a difference between allowing women to go to work and allowing, women to do OnlyFans. You know, should all these freedoms be? Should the state be completely neutral, or society be completely neutral on people exercising whatever freedoms they want?
Well, I think we can discuss as a society what works and what doesn't. I won't be surprised if this younger generation changes, maybe, or the one after that's been brought up in those one-parent households. They might say, and they probably will, you know what, that's not great, that hasn't worked. Or we are interested in a committed relationship for life, or they might go the other way. I mean, but there's no... In a sense, the question you're asking is it good or bad? And the answer is it just is, and it's not going to change. I think it's important to have discussions like we're having, and for people to say, how do we think about what will give us meaning? I see people now, interestingly, there are people looking at ways to give meaning to their life. So some people do the environmental very sort of involved in that. So people do want meaning and they're looking for ways to achieve it. And community is a way of achieving meaning. And in fact, a lot of the psychologists now say there's great wealth unhappiness, and happiness comes from what they call connection, and connection means community. So that might take us then out of this sort of narrow, self-focused arena into a broader one. So I'm not... to give a prognosis on what's going to happen, but that's the job. That will be all of our jobs, to have fulfilling lives, is to sort some of those things out. I don't know about the traditional marriage.
Mm. Who knows? I guess it's I guess everyone's free to debate these things, but at some point the kind of rubber hits the road and you have to, the law exists for a reason. And society makes choices, and law does influence society, that the changes that get made have social consequences.
Dan, you're not suggesting we should sort of ban divorce again or anything?
Well, divorce has always been, depending on the religion, there's a debate to be had, I think, between how, liberal it should be and how restrictive it should be, right? Because I think some things, well, what explains the massive breakdown in marriages over the last sort of 50 years? Surely there's some legal changes that have been responsible for that, right?
But then that's women being able to earn a living. and being able to support themselves and not being locked out of the workforce.
That's part of it, no doubt.
I'll give you an example. My mother, her first marriage, she was married to a former prisoner of war in Papua New Guinea, poor man, and he was a mess, beat her up, and she had a four-year-old daughter, and she had to run. She worked and worked and worked, and she went to the bank, and she said, there's a house in Randwick, and I want to put a deposit on it. And they said, but you're a woman, we're not going to give you a deposit. They're the things that kept women in marriage, very plainly. So there was a whole range of things that prevented women from making decisions to protect themselves and to run their own lives. I don't think any society in which women have a vote will ever go back to that.
But what do you think, it's getting to the weeds, like the OnlyFans phenomenon? I mean, is that something the law should say something about or not?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I know I have a friend whose daughter told her she was on OnlyFans. I've never looked at OnlyFans, right? So I actually have no idea.
I can imagine.
But there's a really big and interesting debate around what people do with their own bodies now. And because there's women with pornography and women as surrogates and all sorts of stuff like that. And that's a difficult one. I would never want to tell a woman what she needs to do to earn money, if that's what she needs. But if it was someone close to me, I would counsel her and say, you pay a price in your soul for that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that that's where the law should come in. I don't think it should at all. I think it's got to be free. And I think as we move along as a society, we might, we might see people addressing these issues in different ways. But, you know, it's nothing different than men play sport and box. They use their bodies to make an income. They punish their bodies. There's all those guys that play AFL and get their heads beaten in. And these women, if they're doing things that if they don't have other ways to earn money and that's what they're doing, then my impulse is really good luck to you.
Do you think non-judgmentalism is a modern virtue that might have been included in your list? Is that something that...
No, because I'm highly judgmental, Dan, so there's no way I'm...
But I do sense, like, just these discussions that with these controversial topics, that your default is, you know...
I think what I'm judging is your nostalgia for an old world. That's what I'm judging, really. I'm saying, Dan, it's gone. That's the judgment I'm making. I love you for it. I love you for this sort of nostalgia. The rose-coloured glasses are lost, and there's things I like about it too, but it's gone and it's not coming back.
What do you think? You wrote a book on Paris, women in Paris, right? Or what do you think that someone sitting on the boulevard in Paris would think most unusual about the way people behave in this current age?
What would they think? I've got no idea, really. I mean, it depends who it is sitting on the boulevard, Dan, doesn't it? Do you mean in terms of manners? Do you mean in terms of...
Yeah, well, all those things. If they were just transported here from that time and they looked around, what would they notice first, and what would they...
Well, I'll put it back in a different way. I don't know if you've seen that. There's a Woody Allen film where he gets it's called Midnight in Paris, right? And he goes back 3 eras and it's, oh, my God, here's Gertrude Stein and here's Ernest Hemingway. Yeah. And then he picks up his girlfriend and they go back and then they're in the sort of gay 1890s and that's a completely different one. It's can and fabulous. So each era is different. We remember it differently. We tend to remember the good bits, not the bad, which is just human nature, or some people do, others don't. The big difference now is our freedom. That's the big difference. We don't have it, really. And that is a problem. And women might say, I could be on OnlyFans and make a lot of money. Should I do this? That's a decision that she must make. A young man might say, someone says, you're going to be a fantastic footballer. And someone else says, but we've just discovered all this stuff on concussion. He's going to have to say, do I want all the money now and take the risk or not? That's modern life, is much more freedom and therefore much more choice, which is hard. There's something very easy about a world with limited choice in it. But
do you think that and in your book on manners, you do, you know, reference everyone from Confucius to a whole stack of them, great thinkers. Do you think they'd never considered the possibility that the best option for society is just to allow people to be as free as possible?
No, I think when I wrote that book about manners, people thought I was writing a book giving a guide to manners. And I was absolutely suggesting that what we need is to think of rules of engagement. That's what manners are useful for. It's how we talk to each other so we can function. Mm. So you and I are talking and we have some views we agree on, but probably many we don't. And we are courteous to each other and civil. And I see that as a good in itself. Mm. And what we know from social media and everything is this terrible polarization has occurred. And it's very difficult now. People find it very hard to talk to each other. And I see that is made worse by a lack of kind of a code of manners or a code of behavior that makes those kind of discussions possible. So I regret the loss of manners, and I especially regret it as I walk down the footpath and nearly get bowled over by a bike rider, you know, who doesn't, and, you know, see it everywhere. But I'm pretty sure that every older person, they have no manners, those young people. So I think that's not a lie. I would also say, however, that whilst we don't have manners, there's lots of good things that have come out of the change in sort of modern ethics. And there is more warmth and more kindness, and there's more there is more tolerance of difference, and there is more readiness to listen to other people's stories and share your own. So the stigmas attached to people's past or their class or their looks or whatever, I think we have that, and I think social media is terrible. But I think in the real world, where I live in the city, it's a very congenial place to live. It's a very crowded part of Sydney, and manners here are actually quite delightful. And I have to say, one thing that's helped manners is dogs, weirdly. We have a dog park near. I do not have a dog, obviously. But people with dogs all talk to each other. And so you get this sort of warmth and community around. And they're casual manners. They're not formal manners. They're not beautiful manners, but they're good. And I live in a strata building. We have manners of how we work together in the strata. So it's all that. It's just thinking about, you know, the context, and there's less official frameworks for these things. We have to figure them out ourselves, I think, case by case a bit.
Yeah. So William Wilberforce, right, the great sort of reformer in the UK, he was famous for abolition of the slave trade, and his other great work was the Reformation of Manners, and he was reacting against that, you know, Hall Garthian Gin Alley society that needed to be improved. Do you think, how do we get, is that something that you're trying to do, was trying to do through that book, or you?
Now that's an interesting question. Yeah, it's interesting. The reason I wrote that book, just as let me remember, was I wrote the book about Paris, and interestingly the publisher came to me and she said, what's really interesting is stuff around manners in this book, and I didn't even know there was stuff around manners. And so I went away, and that's when I started, you know, reading around all the sort of history of manners and all the different way cultures have used manners and trying to figure out what I thought about them. I don't want to be the sort of Wilberforce. There's a bit of the Puritan coming in there, isn't there? There's the bit of the, you know, the upright performer trying to reform badness everywhere. So that wasn't just a manners, it was actually about debauchery and excess and all of those things. Mm. So my interest is in actually a much more kind of small manners, not the large transformation of society, but just how we can get along. And we, here in Australia, we do really well, you know, for a very complex multicultural society. I think we do pretty well. And on a global basis, we do well.
What about like Confucius, though? You know, he started writing in a time when there was a breakdown of the Zhou dynasty, and he was actually very critical about, he may have been a son of a single mom. When people often don't understand, when he stresses things like filial piety, that meant something to him. That was really important. That wasn't just something that it was nice to have. He thought it was essential. I mean, do you think, you know, like, I guess I don't think you quite answered the question before. What would those ancient guys, you know, think of us? It's not as though they hadn't considered the option of just do your own thing, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't think freedom, having this freedom, is necessarily antithetical to having good manners. Or having a form of manners. Mm. He was, as you said, in a period of great social breakdown. We're not in a period of great social breakdown. We're in a period of social stress. Oh, see, that's where we part ways. You think we're in a period of great social breakdown, Dan?
Well, I think Confucius would recognize some similarities between his time and our own.
I think I would land on all of this is I think the problem that we have is extreme selfish individualism, not a breakdown of not a breakdown of structures and so on. We have the structures, but what we have is extreme individualism allied to consumerism, and that we've converted many of us from citizens into consumers. That's been the transition that occurred that I find very, very painful. And of course, when you're a consumer, you buy and sell. And your attitude towards the world is different, isn't it? And that's where you can consume a relationship and throw it away. You know, you end up with a buy and sell kind of attitude. And I guess the argument that I'm making in 21st century virtues is that is a path that's very dangerous, not just because people who are very inward focused and isolated and disaggregated are a target for sort of neoliberalism, but you're also a target for dictators who can pick up your discussion. And that is a bit what we're seeing in America right now. That was the vote for Donald Trump, in part. People saying, we're left out. There's this world of sort of individuals, and we're the people that haven't scored mightily in this system. We've been left behind. Our manufacturing jobs are gone. There's all this inequality and so on. And so very understandably, the appeal to grievance was very effective. So yeah, I think I don't think Confucius could offer any comment on now, because it's just a different world. I just keep coming back to that idea that the task for us is to find our own meaning as individuals, but also to see ourselves as citizens in our society and not just as consumers. And once we change, and that's happening, and a lot of people are doing that, but that's once we do. I mean, this election, everyone hates this election, right? And one thing that's really interesting is a complete collapse of membership of political parties, the big political parties. So we even have citizens, you know, you're talking about the law, we don't have people who are sort of even electorate literate who are out there, you know, talking about policy. So it used to be, if the Labor Party was putting forward weak policies, the biggest, loudest critics of that would be Labor Party members. But there aren't enough of them. And in the Liberal Party too, there was a huge, you know, never as big as the Labor Party, of course, but very influential people who are having discussions and debates and airing them. So that whole civic life has really disappeared, not disappeared, but almost disappeared. And it's just left to journalists reviewing what the leaders say and go, oh, that was lame. And you think, I don't really want to hear what the journalists think, actually, because they're just feeding the news, you know? Yeah. That's the challenge. We need to be citizens again, and we need to think about our community, and we need to think about ways we can structure our activities and our society to mobilize, to support community. And I think also politics is an important part of that.
Yeah.
Not mind you, that I am a member of any political party right now. So I, yeah, too am a disability.
But you have insight. I mean, you used to write speeches for Kim Beazley. You'd know them, the machinations of them quite well, and have an insight into it. So I'm not complete babe in the woods. So do you think, okay, so one of the criticisms that youth conservative thinkers are trying to make is that one of the problems that we have on both political parties is liberalism taken to extremes, and that manifests itself with things like this consumerism and everything being reduced to some sort of, you know, commodity. And on the social side, it results in, you know, in many cases freedom, but in some cases horrible chaos, you know, and adverse consequences to people. And it sort of seems to be the case that people don't have a language anymore to explain why limits exist and why restrictions exist. And that's not nostalgia for another day. That's something that I would say a Confucius would speak to. I'd say that some of the Greek, you know, the Plato and Aristotle and those guys who'd seen their society also completely unwind, can also speak to this. So,
the problem with that, Dan, is that Plato's answer to that problem was a philosopher king, by which he meant a dictator. And so I came across this hilarious story where at one point someone came to him and said, there's a tyrant in Syracuse and he wants your advice on how to run the country. And he's like, at last, my philosopher king went over there, gave his good advice. Poor man didn't understand the life of the political advisor. And the tyrant sold him into slavery. And he was stuck in slavery for months and months, and his friends had to ransom him back. I mean, the problem with this question about where do the limits come from, if the risk of the sort of world you're describing is tyrants, it's dictators, because you're saying someone upstairs needs to make the limits on all of us. And I guess where I part ways very much from you is to say, I don't think we can go back to that, what is literally a paternalistic model of governance. And it's not going to happen, and it wouldn't work. But there is a job. There is a real job about us as individuals and in our communities redefining our own limits, choosing our understanding what freedom looks like and how tough it is, and making fighting on our own limits.
Yeah. I guess I'm more of an Aristotle guy than a Plato guy, but I think it's a little bit of a simplification to say that that was the only what he was talking about, and that he was. But anyway, that and I also think that, look, no one's got a, all societies have their positives and negatives, and you know, there are positives to living in a monarchy. There are positives to living in a democracy. You read people like Alex de Tocqueville. He talks about how democracy has a sort of leveling down effect, and monarchies do actually, in a weird way, create kind of promote excellence and different things. You know, when there are drawbacks as well. Don't get me wrong. Just one point I want to pick up, Alicinda. You said the difference between us is that you don't think it's a period of decline, a societal decline. I think that is a key distinction between kind of still between the left and the right. They think it's this glorious new age. How do you interpret things like you know, dramatic fall off in the birth rate, unsustainable debt, you know, and those types of consequences, are they not at some level examples of how the business model is simply not working anymore?
Yes, you're right. There's real problems. No doubt about that. I hesitate to use the word decline because it just so. It has a sort of sense of, oh my, we're just going down and we can't come back up again. I think I agree that there's real issues. I agree with you. And absolutely, the falling birth rate is really a very clear sign that women have said, you know what, we're not going to. I mean, that's pretty amazing. It's a vote of no confidence in the future, isn't it? So to that extent, you're completely right. I guess I don't think the answer is going back. I think there are ways in which we can make the right changes to deal with the future, but we don't necessarily talk about, you know, it's not, I don't think it's a sort of moral social decline. It's just a political one in that we've got the biggest problem in Australia, one of the biggest problems we have now is longevity. We have huge amounts of our budget is going to be going to keeping baby boomers alive for years and years and years. And you look at the popular, if they did one of those, they do a sort of 5-yearly intergenerational report, terrifying numbers. And so when we're talking about all the things we need to do that will promote the birth rate and good health and so on, there's a huge pot of money that's going to have to spend at this rate on old people. That's the decline is there. That is quite literally the decline, this yeah. huge population. So I see these as practical problems that have to be dealt with and should be dealt with. And I regret that, you know, there's not so much public talk about that. But I have a feeling that Labor is doing more to things than the Liberal Party. I don't think there's any sort of interest in that. Yeah, we need to, all the stuff on housing and all these things. We have to deal with the fact that one of the issues with a really big aging population is you have to keep bringing people in. One of the big part jobs that we're bringing immigrants for is caring for old people, and that's caring for old people. So that's a whole area. That is just a practical thing. We have to deal with it. No one wants to. And the reason they don't want to is because it's very scary to talk about things around aging and death. That's very scary. And people haven't, we as free human beings haven't worked up the courage to talk about those things properly yet. So that's another question, isn't it? How do you find meaning? What do you do? How do you organize society in that way? How do we come together to fix something out about this? In the old days, you know, you'd, until they die.
Yeah.
And in the old days, they did die, but now they don't die, you see. Pope Francis is still alive. He's died about 4 times, the poor bastard, and they still won't let him, and they brought him out on a wheelchair, and he'll keep going. You know,
yeah. These questions, you know, I just sort of sometimes think some of these questions were considered in the past, and now we've thrown away some of the answers that were given, and now trying to think that we can create them all anew. On the question of decline, I think you can make an argument that there has been for it, but I think in a broader sense, what distinguishes the left and the right is that the right have a sense of that there can be a tragic element to whatever system you set up, and there are necessarily always going to be trade-offs, not one way or another. Whereas the left, and I know you criticize this in your book, have a much more therapeutic view of how life should be, and just because they want it to be so, that's how it should be. Do you recognize that phenomenon?
That's very interesting. I would say there's utopianism on both sides. There's a utopianism which is a nostalgia, and there's a utopianism which is eternal progress. I think you can get it wrong. You can say, wasn't the past glorious? No, actually, no. And you can also say we strive endlessly towards an ever-perfecting future, and that's also probably wrong. I think we just keep muddling through.
Yeah. Yeah, good. That's good. Just to finish up on this question, it struck me that there are Australians produce Hollywood movie stars. We produce renowned musicians. We produce, but what we don't produce in the same way that the British and even the Americans produce are public intellectuals. And I wonder why that is, because we have good journalists. We have very successful media proprietors, regardless of what you think about them. And yet we don't have the sort of Douglas Murray types, or we don't have the sort of Jordan Peterson types, or we don't have the Rory, whatever his name is, who came out here on a lecture tour. I mean, that, you know, I don't particularly think he is so, you know, such a genius that, but he's out here. It's not Lucinda lecturing people in Leeds and Manchester, right? Why do you think that is?
Well, we do. Peter Singer is one of the world's leading public intellectuals. He is absolutely right at the forefront. I'm sure there are others. There will be others, and I just can't think of them because my brain is faded. But there will be others. I think
we don't have the same. Back in the day, we had the Germaine Greers and the Clive James and the Robert Hugheses, all that stuff. Like, I don't think there's the equivalent of those guys now, right?
No, it's true. It's interesting. Maybe we will. Maybe we have a burst. You know, every 30 years, someone comes up. It's not going to be me, but it's could be you, Dan. You could just get out there and start.
I'm looking at this not from a personal perspective, but from a more nationalistic side of things. I mean, why do we have to listen to these Brits rather than or others?
I don't really listen to them, I read books, but I take your point. I mean, I don't think we have a strong conservative intellectual tradition in Australia, really.
I agree.
Yeah. I agree. And so that's kind of, I think, what you're thinking about. I mean, someone like, and even those others that you mentioned, I mean, Germaine Greer has always been interesting because she's been her own category of commentator. Robert Hughes was the same. And they were a really interesting bunch. But maybe this is a product of a society which is far happier than the societies that those people come from. I have the impression that if you're British, you feel pretty upset with things. Things are pretty, you know? And they've had really big sort of fundamental kind of philosophical things about who are we and what are we. Mm. So maybe that's a sign of a happy society that we're not so intellectual. I don't know.
I was actually saying to Philip Blond, there is a British shtick where they're always writing these articles, a warning from Britain to America about, you know, the terrible future. And that's their that's this piece, and it works well, whereas they're not going to listen to that from an Australian because they associate us Bluey and restful crocodiles.
I don't know if you've watched this on streaming called The Residence. I watched the first episode last night. Okay, it's a very comic murder mystery set in the White House, and the event at which the murder occurs is a state dinner for the Australian Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister. Urge you to watch it because you will see what Americans think of Australians, because it has the Australian Foreign Minister out the back having sex with the chef during the murder. And it is so funny, and I'm weirdly, strangely believable. I just thought it's not completely the question.
Yeah, well, that's our brand. You can trade off it for better or worse. Hey, Lucinda, I've really enjoyed catching up with you again. If people want to find out, well, what are you working on? And if people want to find out more about your work, where do they go?
What am I working on? I am working on a book that I am calling Longevity Blues, which is about longevity. And so apologies for bringing it up. It's in my mind. It's a sort of a really big fundamental question that we at all levels have found too scared to confront. Mm. I have a website with almost nothing. So it's thingaholdforth.com. That's all. Not much. I'm not on a million platforms. I don't do that.
Hey, look, I encourage people to go and certainly read that 21st Century Virtues book and others. It's an interesting perspective, and I think it was good amongst other things because your audience were your friends on the left, and it made them hopefully think a little bit.
That's the plan. That's my aim in life, is to slightly piss everyone off.
Yeah, that's right. I'm the same, and sent to do it successfully. Great to talk, and look forward to catching up. Have a good day. See you, mate. Bye.
And thank you. Bye.